Without further ado, I'd like to introduce to you Ed M. from Davenport, Iowa.
Good evening. My name's Ed Mutum, and I'm an alcoholic. It's so good to be back in California. I'm delighted to be here. I want to thank everybody who invited me. I'm blessed I get to travel a little bit and talk a little bit. And I don't know that I've ever been treated kinder or with more consideration than I have since I arrived here Thursday. It's really been great. And for Kathy and Sandy and for Sorelli, everybody who's been kind to me, thank you. That always touches me, because when I got here, there was nothing to be kind to. I've really been blessed since I've been here. Lee and I went and had dinner Thursday, and the waitress picked up my check, and I walked down the hall and ran into Karen and Johnny, and they were getting a haircut, and I went in there to get a haircut, and they wouldn't let me pay. And that's the way my life is today. And it's because of the way you taught me to be. But it didn't start out that way. For those of you who don't know me, yes, I have trouble buying clothes. The weather's fine up here. Thank you very much. Cut to the chase on those. Leave those behind us. And it's always the same two questions by the same size person. First question is,
oh, how tall are you?
6'10".
Oh, do you play basketball?
No. How tall are you?
5'4".
Oh, do you play miniature golf? Seems fair to me. I'm just trying to play by their rules, you know. My favorite answer, though, is when somebody says, why don't you play basketball? I said, you know, I had a drinking and a drug problem from a very early age and didn't realize I was this tall until I got sober. You guys laugh. They just kind of scratch their head and look at me, you know. But I love God. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love being sober, and I don't apologize for any of it anymore. And, man, I'm pleased about that. I'm pleased to be here. There are people in this room that I love with all my heart. That if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be breathing, period. And I love that. I love that. There's people in this room that have invited me into their home and fed me when I wouldn't have had me in my home and fed me, you know. There's people in this room that taught me how to eat, taught me table manners, and I'm grateful for that. That my sponsor told me about breaking bread and what fork to use and how to use it. You see, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea. I had no idea, and I really didn't want to know. I come from a very elite group of people called white trash, and there's certain things that are expected of you, and by God, we followed through with all of them. You know, it was just pretty good, and I joke about it now, but from a very early age, I realized there was something wrong with me, and I don't know why. My brothers and sisters, I'm the youngest of seven, and my dad was one of the hardest working men I've ever known in my life. He was a foundry worker. And I don't know if you've ever been in a foundry, probably not a lot of them out here, but that foundry sand weighs about 6 times what regular sand weighs. And he was just amazing. I remember I was 16, 17. I was not planned for. And Dad was about 63, 64, and I was 16, 17. And he outworked me. I couldn't keep up with him. That man could work. Mom always told the story about Dad during the Depression days was shoveling coal for 25 cents a ton and came home one day after making $18. You know, the old man could work. But he drank like he worked, you know, and he drank hard. And alcoholism and craziness was a part of my life. I don't know when I took my first drink. It really doesn't matter. What matters is that I took the drink. I don't know that I can remember that first drink, because they used to think it was funny to get me drunk when I was a kid. So I don't know when all that happened. But real early in life, I figured this out, that it felt better with a little drink. You know, I'd look out at this world and think, you know, I just don't get it. I just don't get it. The other thing I thought is I don't want to be here. I didn't like life going in. I don't know why. I just didn't, you know. I'd look at the house and the I can remember God going to church. Mom used to drag us to church. That was always fun, you know. And there'd always be some preacher up there. All ministers have thin blue lips and talk like this. They just all do. Whenever you want, watch, you know. And I'd walk into church and they'd say, "You're going to burn in hell, young man. That's what you're going to do. You're going to burn in hell." And I thought, how do you know? I only been here an hour. But he knew. And I started doing something then that almost cost me my life then and after getting sober. I call it my 299-to-1 theory. I could walk into a room of 300 people. 299 could turn around to me and say, "Ed, you're the best. We love you." And one could go, "Jerk." Guess who got my full attention? Now, that wasn't bad enough, but real early in life, the 299 didn't exist anymore. And I started putting those ones in my life. You know, I put them in that bag and I'd carry them through life. And after a while, when you're young like that, you don't need a lot of ones to make you think life isn't worth much. And that's what I did with church. I'd look at that preacher and I remember there's some guy set up front and he had, you know, thin blue lips looking really holy. And I thought he had a lot more fun in the bar I saw him in last night, but, you know, and I judged the entire church by that one guy. Forget the 299 that were sitting behind them, probably wonderful people. You see, I had my evidence. Life isn't any good. And I became a collector of ones, and it almost killed me. And if you're a collector of ones at any age, you need something to drink. Because when you drink, it doesn't make the ones matter so much. In fact, if you drink enough, you can pretend they don't even exist. And you can make it one day at a time. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 10 years old. I've got a brother sober 44 years. He's so dry we don't let people smoke around him anymore. Might go up in flames. You know how those old timers are, you know. And he took me to meetings, and I remember the meeting I went to. There was some old guy up there, about 30. And he was saying, "My name's Fred, and I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, good for you, Fred, you know. I can't wait to get out of here. And I share that with you for one simple reason. There's people in this room tonight that have somebody you love. And they're out there drinking and using. You've tried to carry the message and it didn't register. Old friend of mine used to say, "You can't see till you can see and you can't hear till you can hear." And that was certainly true with me. I hung around Alcoholics Anonymous a lot. My brother, I worked for him when they booted me out of school and things like that. And we'd always end up in that A&A club, you know. And those people were okay, but I didn't think I'd ever be into cribbage or picnics. So, you know, I didn't get it. And every time I got in trouble, I didn't think I need 12 golden steps to walk up. I had the problems already at 10, 11, and 12 that everybody else has. It was already memories of what might have been. It was if onlys. It was why was I born? What's the deal? And they said stupid stuff in AA. They said, "You know, you keep drinking and using, you're going to die." And I thought, when? When? They'd say, "We could restore your life." I'd say, "Why?" That was not attractive to me. It was just not attractive to me. I did everything I could to get out of this world. I promise you. Everything I could to get out of this world because I knew one thing, that life wasn't worth living. And at the ripe old age of 13, I was arrested by the Iowa Highway Patrol for possession of a sawed-off shotgun. And I had already gotten to the point where I was just scared of you. I was going to hurt you before you hurt me, you know. And I remember they threw me in jail to teach me a lesson because I already had a brother there that was a three-time loser. And they thought they'd teach me a little lesson. And I can remember acting tough and crazy at 13. Of course, I was 6'6", so they thought I was 20. But I got in that cell and I cried myself to sleep and I hoped to God nobody could see me. Because I was lonely as I'd ever been. And I just didn't know what to do. Got kicked out of school at the age of 13. They said I had an attitude problem. I told them they had one. They won. They had all the rules. And I went out and I was blessed that I had some friends teach me a career. It was burglary. And it was really nice, but I grew out of that. You can't be this tall and be a good burglar, you know. I mean, Johnny, who was it? It was him, officer. Yeah. God. God, it was amazing. My mother asked me to stop coming around the house. I called her 3 o'clock in the morning to bail me out. And she didn't even ask who it was. She just picked up the phone and said, no. Click. And sometime after I got sober, about 7, 8 years sober, I was able to go home and talk with Mom. And she told me about that, and she cried. Still broke her heart that she had to do that. And I had to say, Mom, if you hadn't done that, God knows where I'd be. God knows where I'd be. It was the toughest thing she ever did, but it was the best thing for me because, you see, I was one of those who wouldn't take no for an answer, especially my mother. I knew I could push her long enough and hard enough, and eventually she'd give in. And I can remember her crying and just upset. Go ahead, do it. You might as well just do it. And I remember when they asked me not to come in the house anymore, for good reason. I remember a story the other day that I hadn't thought of in years. I didn't think of myself as a thief. I thought of myself as a liberator. And I had liberated a liquor store the night before. And what terrified me was I had a good chance of getting caught. Not that I hit the liquor store. It's that, sheesh, we were just, I didn't remember a whole lot. And my dad came downstairs, and Mom had Dad on allowance that time at $1 a day, so he wouldn't drink. And Dad came downstairs, and he said, boy, what are you doing? He heard some chinking and that, and I was stuffing bottles of booze in the heating vents and everything to hide it. He said, boy, where'd you get all this stuff? And I said, oh, Dad, we went over to cross the river, and I told him what happened. He said, well, that's horrible. We got to get rid of this. Go up and get a couple glasses. Mom couldn't figure out why Dad was so drunk on $1 a day. I finally explained that to her. But I didn't do anything that stuff with bravery or macho. It was a lot of stuff I just got into over my head too quick, you know. And I was always afraid. I was always afraid. I hid my being afraid by anger and trying to be tough. And, you know, the tougher somebody acts, the more afraid they are. That's just been my experience. And with the people I sponsor and work with, if they got a real attitude, they're just afraid they're going to get caught doing whatever they're doing. That's drunk or sober. And, boy, I came to AA with a lot of stuff. You see, I not only had alcoholism, I was a jerk as well. And it was all about me, and I took advantage of people at every given moment, and it took me a number of years to figure out that I was even doing that. But I did it, and I did it, I thought, well, January 5th of 1971 was my last drink or mood-altering chemical. And that morning, I was in a car wreck, and I laid in the middle of the street pretending like I was knocked out. I'm not sure why it seemed like a good idea at the time. And the police came, and they were not kind to me for good reason. I used to hate them and say that they're the reasons I never got sober, but then one guy cut me a good break when he had everything on me, and I couldn't say that anymore. But I remember laying in the middle of the street. It was 18 below zero, January 5th, and I'm laying in the middle of the street. I'd bumped my head pretty good. We were in a car accident, and I got thrown out. They came up and they said, that's Mutum. Don't touch him. He's the scum of the earth. And I agreed with them. There was just nothing I could say. And I was a cop fighter, a feeble one at that, but I was a cop fighter. I just, God, if a cop took you out, then you're somebody. You know, then you get to be a hero. Then you get to be something. And I remember they said that, and I just agreed. And they rolled me into the hospital that night, and they rolled me by some nurse that I don't know who it was, and I don't know that I've seen her since. And she said, Ed, do you want me to call AA? And I went, might as well. And that was my sincere entrance into Alcoholics Anonymous. And us old-timers want to know why you new people can't be sincere like we were in the old days. The only thing I knew that night is I couldn't drink, and I couldn't do the other things I was doing, and I was doing a lot of other things long before it was fashionable. And this guy come up, and his name was Hap. There's somebody you want to see, you know. Got a brain concussion and a headache and hung over. Somebody happy coming to see you, you know. And he said, welcome home, Ed. And nobody'd said that to me in a long time, so I guess he caught me speechless. And he said, we don't drink and we don't use one day at a time. And I said, you don't get it. I can't make it a day. I just can't make it a day. And he said, well, all you have to do is try, and that's the only thing I've done consistently from that day to this. Sometimes I've tried greatly, sometimes I've tried barely, but I've tried. And that's my sobriety date, and I started going to meetings, and I remember I was sober about 3 months, and old-timer named Logan, who just passed away with 57 years of sobriety last year, walked in and said, I had my feet up on the desk, and I was thinking I was pretty cool. And Logan said, you think you got all the answers, don't you, kid? And I said, no, but I was thinking, yep, pretty much got this wrapped up. And he said, well, let me tell you something. I was young once, but you've never been old. It is the first time in my life I ever conceived the possibility that you have felt the way I feel. That you know that emptiness and you know that loneliness. And I was a shaker, man. I miss shakers. There's some of us around here who remember good shakers, and they just, God, how are you? Oh, good, Ed. Yeah, yeah, nice to see you, buddy. You want coffee? Oh, no, thanks. No, thanks. I'll be. And they had the old porcelain cups, and you could get half cup going, and it was just wonderful, you know. And I had two rules. Don't come up behind me and don't touch me, because I had no idea what was going to happen, you know. And in this meeting I'd go to was a guy named Harry Stevens. He passed away, and Harry was about this tall, and he was as big around as he was tall. And Harry'd come in, and he'd pour the coffee in the meeting. And Harry'd come in, and he'd put his hand right on my shoulder. And he'd pour my coffee. And as soon as his hand went there, everything was okay. The madness stopped, the voices and the screaming, and I could breathe. And he'd take his time pouring that coffee. And then he'd go pour again, and I'd drink that coffee just as quick as I could. You see, I was a tough guy. How could I tell Harry, Harry, you're saving me. Thanks for a human touch that doesn't want anything, that I don't feel violated about. You know? Thanks. They always say it doesn't matter what you say in AA. I don't quite believe that. I would have been run out of here a lot of times. Thank God for guys like Harry, who genuinely cared. I remember there was a guy 2 years later in Santa Monica, when I was going through a suicidal depression, which I tended to do from time to time, through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That doesn't happen anymore. I know that upsets some people. Pray for me. I appreciate it. And but that's what it was. And a guy's name was Jim Ryan. And Jimmy was from Texas, and he always rubbed his hands and talked together, and they rapid-fire talk. And he gave a good talk. He was from Dallas, Texas, lived in Malibu. And I was living in my sponsor's garage at that time, working up a skyrocket to success at about 3 years sober. And I was planning on going back to the garage and turning on the gas and just taking a little nap, because they had some big coffee pots there that pretty much do the job. And no heroics. I wasn't calling anybody. I just wanted out. I knew that I couldn't make it. There was a lot of nice people around me trying to help me, but I just knew that I couldn't make it. Maybe you could, but I couldn't. And I'd walk into that club at 26th and Broadway. And I don't know if Jimmy said it to everybody. I don't really care. I know he said it to me. It seems like every time I was in that dark pit, I'd walk in there and Jim would be there and I'd say, how are you, Jim? And it was like the world stopped. And he looked me right in the eye, and it felt like he took my face like this. He didn't, but that's how it felt. He looked me right in the eye. I'd say, how are you, Jim? And he'd say, I'm much better for seeing you, my friend. Much better for seeing you. And he saved my life that day. Because one more put down would have done it. And I'd think, you know, if Jim likes me, maybe there's something to hang on to here. Started going to meetings at about 6 months sober, you get honesty. At about 8 months, you get a little tact to go with it, you know. And I'd suggest you wait for the tact. Just my suggestion. And there was a priest there named Tom, Father Tom. And he had thin blue lips, talk like this. You know what I mean. And he was in the group, and he said, Ed, why don't you go back to church? And I had the honesty part, so I told him. I said, I'll tell you why I don't go back to church. It's full of thieves, hypocrites, and liars. And I felt good about telling him. And he looked at me and looked back at me and said, well, why don't you come? One more won't hurt. I punished him. I didn't talk to him for a couple months, I'll tell you. But today when I see him, I tell him I love him and I'm grateful that he was there. You know, a few years back was my 30th anniversary and my sponsor came out to talk. And there were six men who were really involved in helping me stay sober. And all six of them were there and still sober 30 years later. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous works. It really, really works. We don't need to fix it. We need to apply it. And that was my trouble. See, these guys could apply it, but for some reason it wouldn't get through here to get to my feet. I was so terminally unique, I guess. I made a major mistake that year. They said you had to believe in God. And I thought, well, that isn't going to work because God's a chump, you know. He is. He's just a chump. He lets kids starve. There's cancer everywhere. He's killed most of the people in my family. You know, I remember my cousin, I was 10, 12 years old. I remember her, if anybody was godlike, it was Linda. And Linda graduated from high school. She had a full ride scholarship. She was beautiful. She was talented. And she was walking across the street, and a truck hit her and killed her. And do you know what people said to me? God must have wanted an angel. And I thought, so he hits you with a truck. I'll pass. You know what? Still will. Still will. It's funny today because my office is right on that very corner. And every day when I walk across that street, I celebrate Linda's life. Isn't it funny how we look for reasons to feel bad? Guy came into me a while back and he had lost a daughter a few years ago, and he was already planning the depression on the anniversary of her death. And I said, well, you can do that, but why don't you do this? If you really want to heal and if you really want to do something, why don't you start celebrating her life that day? All that she meant to you and all that she was. And celebrate her memory, and rather than make it all about you. God, he got mad and stormed out, and I understand it. Because, you see, I love that kind of pain. Made me a victim. Give me reasons to do whatever I wanted to do. And by God, you had it coming. And I learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that I got to walk away from that victim stuff. That it isn't good anymore. That I don't have to have it anymore. That I can be happy, joyous, and free. And this is the only place I've ever learned to do that. Well, I brought up the God thing because I made a mistake. I started professing a faith I didn't have. Now, that's dangerous because in my experience, there's going to be a day when your life is going to depend on your faith. It talks about it in the big book very clearly. You know, there will be a time when there will be no defense against that first drink. And I didn't know it, but if you're just mouth and words, Mary Pearl said it wonderfully today in her talk. And I was one of those. I used to go to AA and people would say, how you doing? I'd say, fine. How are you? Nice to see you. And I'd go out and be the same jerk I always been, you know, to the people I work with and to my bosses and flipping off people and just, you know, I wasn't fine at all. I didn't know how to tell the truth. I didn't know how to be fine. So I'd tell you fine and I'd lie. Well, I started doing the same thing with God. God's in his heavens, all right with the world. I became so spiritual I was of no earthly good. And, you know, I was 20 years old, and I was somewhat of a novelty at that time. There wasn't a lot of people around sober. The other thing I just hated was people would say, oh, it's so nice to see you young people get here before you really had to hurt. I thought, I can change that, you know. But I think of it today, too, because more and more younger people are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, and they hear that stuff. And would any of us, if we had been cancer sufferers, walk into a room of a young person, 16, 17, 13, 14, go up to their bedside and say, my cancer was much worse than yours. Wouldn't that be stupid? What's the difference? It's just a thought. But I found some people who looked past my age and looked into my eyes. And eventually that's what was going to save my life. I professed that faith, and I started talking in meetings at a very young age, probably too newly sober. I was an example of a young person getting sober, and they almost killed me with that. But I'd never been anywhere where people welcomed me. I didn't understand that, and I sure didn't feel worthy of it, but I sure didn't want it to quit anytime soon. And I started professing that faith, and I was just a little over a year sober, and the old man called me up and said, why don't you come over for dinner? And I thought, uh-oh, here it goes, you know. And because every time Dad asked me to dinner, it was trouble. You know, I'd done something. But I'd hung around you folks long enough that you told me to bring an old, new attitude into old situations and suit up and show up. And I showed up for dinner, and I didn't know what to expect. We got about halfway through dinner, and the old man said, "Boy," and I thought, "Oh, God, here it comes." I said, "Yeah, Pop." He said, "Just wanted to tell you I'm proud of you." Now, I need to share something with you. If you had put a lie detector on me when I walked into that house that night and said, "Do I give a darn about what he thought about me?" I would have said no, and it would have registered true. I am so glad I was so wrong. When he said that to me, it meant more than anything I can tell you. When I got sober, they said, "Dream." That wasn't even on the list. That was too far away from what I could do. Anybody could do. The old man would never be proud of me. I'd goofed up way too much. And he told me he was proud of me. It was one of the best nights of my life. And I went to a meeting afterwards, and about 10:30, 11, my mother called me, and she was crying and hysterical and said, "Ed, come home quick. There were police cars and sirens, and Dad had gone across the street to get him a quart of beer and her a bottle of pop. She said, they're carrying bodies out, and I don't know what's going on." And I said, "Don't worry, Ma, everything's fine." And I drove across that street. And in the Midwest, we get those ice storms where you get a quarter inch ice over everything, you know. It can be really nasty. And it was one of those nights, so it took me a while to get there. And I walked up. I drove up to the bar where I'd spent a lot of years. I'd been drinking in there since I was 11. Drove up there, and there were more policemen there than I'd ever seen in my life. And it's funny how they'd shaped up in that year I'd been sober. I'd been working in the courts, not as a professional, but as a member of AA. At that time, we'd go in and the judge would let us take people to meetings, you know. Those were some of the great days. Those were the days when we walked around with tongue depressors and adhesive tape wrapped around them, because somebody's going to go into convulsions, just a matter of time. And you just try to keep them quiet so the meeting can continue, you know. That was good stuff. That was good stuff. They had a thing called paraldehyde where we used to dose them with that, and the ether from that breath would come out, and it, man, it'd put you to sleep sometimes. And sometimes we'd lose them during the night. They'd die, and we had to call the coroner, you know. I don't ever want to forget those shakes, and I don't ever want to forget setting up with those people. And I don't ever want to forget what alcoholism really does. We don't see a lot of it anymore because they medicate you right on through it, which is crying shame. Because I got a feeling if a lot more people felt the real pain, they wouldn't want to go there right away again. And I'd been working in the courts, and the police were there, and they knew I was sober. Both sides knew I was sober. The good guys and the bad guys. The bad guys thought I was a narc, and the good guys thought I was up to a drug deal. So I had company pretty much everywhere I went. But they knew I was sober, and I walked into that place. And in retrospect, I shouldn't have been allowed in there, but I did. And I walked in, and there was an officer standing there, and he said, "What are you doing here, Ed?" And I said, "My dad was in here." He said, "Oh, my God." And I said, "Why? What happened?" He said, "We don't know. All we can tell you is somebody walked in and shot everybody." And I looked down the bar, and I saw that pool of blood with my father's glasses all mangled up in it. And I knew what was going on, but I didn't want to know. You know how that is when something hurts so bad you just don't want to know? And I said, "Well, where's everybody at?" And they said they took all the bodies up to the hospital. So I went up to the hospital, and I ran into an officer who hadn't forgotten my past. And he wasn't very kind to me. And he was rather vulgar about asking me to leave. And very descriptive about what he thought of me. And a miracle happened. I just said, "Okay," and I left. And I went down home, and I called the guy that I'd least expect to call ever. And it was the narc, the head of narcotics, that tried to put me away for the last 5 years of my drinking and using. But he knew I was sober. And I called him up, and he fed me information as it came in. And we came with one conclusion, two conclusions. That he had been shot and wandered outside, or they took him hostage. So we formed a manhunt, and we searched all night. And I wouldn't wish that on anybody, you know. I had always hoped people wouldn't know that kind of sadness and that kind of pain. And then September 11th happened, and we all got a taste of it, didn't we? But it's horrible looking for your father. You're looking under parked cars. You're looking under benches. And the only thing that had come to mind was that serenity prayer, and it had come to mind one word at a time. And I didn't even have craziness at that point. I just had that serenity prayer, thank God. And we formed a search party, and at about 8 o'clock the next morning, that officer from the hospital called me up and said, "Well, Ed, anybody could have made a mistake. You want to come up and identify your old man?" And I said, "Okay." And I went up to the hospital, and I walked into that morgue, and I saw my father there with that bullet hole in his face. And I just got sad, and I got very cold, and I got as about alone as I've ever been. And I reached for that faith I'd been professing and came up with absolutely nothing. Make sure that faith you're talking about is something real, because your life's going to depend on it. Thank God for the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. My first thought when I was in that morgue is they were right when I used to go to church. I'd gathered a lot of ones. God's going to punish everybody you love for what you did was one of them I remembered. And I thought, my behavior killed my father. But the minute I walked out of that morgue, there was a member of AA sitting right there. One of the guys that was at that meeting when I celebrated 30 years. And just seeing him helped me know that it was going to be okay, because I had no God to believe in then. You know, people say, well, somebody believes in a doorknob. Isn't that stupid? And I say, no, if that's what they believe, believe. Get honest with what you can believe. And if it's a doorknob, if it's a telephone pole, who cares? Believe. If it wasn't for the people in AA, and if it wasn't eventually for the sponsor I got, I would not be alive today. They became my reason for being, and they kept me around long enough so I could find a God of my very own. And I am so grateful for that. But everywhere I went, there was a member of AA, and they wouldn't get right in front of you. They'd just give you a little wink and a little heads up, you know, and it was like my God. Everywhere I went, they were. And I remember the funeral, and it was a huge funeral. It's still Iowa's most heinous crime, and please God, it'll stay that way. We don't need any more of that stuff. And at the funeral, the priest said something, gave me a key to the kingdom. He said, you know, a lot of people would say Clifford's death is God's will. He said, I don't believe that. And I sat right up in the pew. He said, God created human beings, gave them a free will. They chose to do this act, and now it's God's will. And it was like the weight of the world fell off my shoulders. You mean the reason there's starving kids in the world is because we're not feeding them? That's right. Don't blame God anymore. The reason cancer's rampant is because we pollute everything we touch. Don't blame God anymore. That's exactly right. You see, I came to believe then, and I believe it more today than ever before, that if it isn't good, it isn't God. But I had a ton of emotions that were killing me. Homicide, you know, and just wanting to get even. And I remember sitting down with a few guys in AA, and I tried to tell them how I was feeling, and they got up and walked away and said, I thought you had a good program. And I thought I had too. And in retrospect, I had quite a good one, because I was telling them what was really going on. They just couldn't handle it, and they walked away. And I thought, well, I better not be too honest in AA anymore. So I started my fine, and you? God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. How are you? Nice to see you. Because I thought, if you ask me to leave here, I don't know what I'll do. Short time later, the police arrested five young men, and the murder trial was there, and I remember sitting across from this guy, and I'm thinking, you know, you give me 5 minutes with him, we don't need a murder trial. He had his little attitude going and thought he was tough. I thought, bring them all five in. We can handle this real quick. But you guys had ruined me. You told me I had to behave, that I might be the only member of Alcoholics Anonymous they ever see, an example of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went into court, and I did what you told me. And I had a suit that was terrible. Fit like this, and they were all too short, but I went. And I just answered the questions, and I left. And when I left, I tried to put that to rest, but the emotions were. Shortly after that, God talked to me. Now, you got to be careful when God talks to you. There's a lot of some of my friends God talked to, and they're still in there. They might get out someday, but I'm not sure when. And I really believe this is where sponsorship is so strong. Sponsors are God's filters. I remember going to my sponsor one day and telling him a plan God gave me. And he said, Ed, this message from God looks strangely like your handwriting. You know? And it was. But it's very important. But it talks in our book about being able to, being inspired all the time. Can you imagine that? You really want to change your life? 86, 87, and 88. You do that for 30 days, your life will change phenomenally if you got the courage to do it. But God talked to me and said, Ed, go out to California. Go into show business. I thought, well, it makes perfect sense to me, you know. So I went out to California. I came to where all stars get their start, Anaheim, California. I applied for a job at Disneyland. I was goofy. And little did they know how well I fit the role at that point. 2.5 years sober, no sponsor, and quit going to meetings. I just go into the Anaheim Club and tell them how good I was doing, you know. And then think about bridge abutments on the way home. But you see, you can't say that because they might kick you out. And a guy walked in, a guy named Tom from the Anaheim Club, walked in one day, said, hey, you want to go to this meeting in West L.A.? And I said, sure, why not? And I went up there and I walked into a group of people that were excited about sobriety, living, talking, going to meetings, doing things, moving people. And you see, I came from AA where you stood up once a year and they flipped you a chip. There you are, Fred. Thank you very much. See you later. You know, I'm just doggone happy to be sober. And I'm not putting that down. A lot of people stay sober that way, but it was tough for me. And there was a lot of people in here and a lot of younger people, and they were doing things, you know. The next week I walked in to that meeting, and I was just so impressed by it. There was a spark of life there that was fanning my little spark I had left, I guess, if you get down to it. And there was a guy there, and I didn't know really who he was, but I said, excuse me, would you be my sponsor? He said, no. And I kind of knew the rules. You can't, it's an AA request. He said, I said, why not? He said, anybody I sponsor has to look up to me. I thought, oh, good, tall jokes. That's really good. I like those. And a few minutes later, he came up to me and said, you agree to do a few things, I'll be your sponsor. My name's Clancy. And he shook my hand, and he saved my life. I am forever grateful I didn't hear some of the stuff that goes around about a lot of the wonderful people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know why I'm grateful? Because if I had heard some of the things said, I would have died, because I would have believed you. You would have killed me with your mouth. I try to make it my purpose not to put down any individual or group in AA. I may not like what they're doing, but I want you to have the dignity of your own choice. There are some things I love in AA, and there are some things I do in my home group that I love my home group. But God, I just want the best for you. And I'll give you the best of my advice without trying to take anybody else's inventory or trying to tell you I'm God. Because Clancy saved my life the way he saw Alcoholics Anonymous. He looked into my eyes and I knew there wasn't any stories to tell anymore. That I was lost and I was alone and he knew it. And I moved into his garage. And he pulled a lot of strings and got me a job as a bellhop at the Royal Inn in Santa Monica. And they had a little blue jacket that was just as nice as that other one. And a little blue hat, and I'd sit there from 11 to 7. And Clancy gave me information. He said, I don't care what you think. They don't lock you up for what you think. They lock you up for how you act. Watch how you act. In a kind and loving way. And I remember sitting there and people would come in and drop their bag on my foot. Little old ladies, pick up that bag, boy. And I'd think, which one? You were it. He said I was allowed to think that. What I did is said, yes, ma'am. And I took the bag and I'd go upstairs and I'd open it and wait for the tip. And they'd shut the door and like to break my fingers. And I'd think, I'm going to kick in the door, grab this old broad door out the window and watch her splatter. But what I did is I'd say, thank you, and I'd go downstairs. Now, that doesn't sound like much, does it? It's called freedom from the bondage of self. I didn't know that if I thought it, I didn't have to do it. You may have. I didn't. It's one of the greatest freedoms I've ever known. I don't have to listen to my own head anymore, no matter how loud it's screaming. What a gift, you know? And he told me I had to start all over on the steps, and I said, you know, I've been through the steps, and he said, well, you obviously didn't do something right, or you wouldn't be living in my garage. Well, he had me there, so I started all over on the steps, and I wrote a four-step. He told me to write a four-step, and I really was honest in it. I wrote and wrote like 4 days and 4 nights. I just wrote. And I finished it up, and Clancy was out of town right then, and I went in to have a cup of coffee with Charlotte and Clancy's wife. And I went in there and said, Charlotte, I'm done with my whole good Ed. Good job. Good, good, good. And I finished the coffee, and I came back out. Walked into the garage, and at that time, Clancy had a goat named Alfred. Beautiful, long-haired goat. And he was finishing off the last page of my inventory. Made me crazy. I went and said, Charlotte, that goat ate my inventory. She said, oh, my God, I hope you don't get the runs. I thought, typical Al-Anon answer for you, you know. Clancy came back, and I told him, I said, Clancy, that goat ate my inventory. He said, bet you found that hard to swallow. In a kind and loving way. And the bad news is, a few days later, the goat died. That's a true story. I guess in a way it was my first sacrifice at the altar. I felt horrible about that. But all of a sudden, Clancy was telling me to do things I didn't understand. He said I could do more than I thought I could. And he pushed me, and I'm grateful for that. I remember when he left me a note in the garage. I'd been living in his garage for some time, and it was a note saying, Ed, you need to be out of this garage at 6 a.m. He said, I may have overhelped you. You need to get out of this garage, and you need to do something. And I'll remain your sponsor if you wish me to. But you need to be out of this garage at 6 o'clock in the morning. And I cried myself to sleep because it's the only guy I ever knew that understood. And he forced me to be self-supporting ever since then. But it's true. It's true. You know, I've had to sponsor people like that, too, that you got to give them those tough deals. And I'm so grateful he believes in what he believes. And I left there, and I got a job, and I got a lot of bad jobs. But I can remember on, I believe it's 26th and Cloverfield, there's a little motel. It was there still in March, and they had the crappiest little rooms in the world. And I was living there, and I was cleaning apartments to get food. And I went across, and there was a little store, and I got a loaf of bread, a pound of bologna, and a quart of milk. And I went over and made my little table, and I said my grace, and one of the most amazing things happened to me. I was grateful for my bologna and bread and my milk. Didn't need anything else. I don't know that I'd ever known that feeling before. Somewhere along the line, it certainly wasn't from my mother and father, I had this thing of somebody owed me something. I was entitled to something. And it's the first time I was ever grateful for just what I had, you know. And Clancy encouraged me to be active, and this is the first convention I ever came to. It was wonderful. I think the first year was Bakersfield. I might be wrong in that, but I was active in this convention. I worked in security, and I did a lot of things. I love this Southern California convention, so it just makes it more of an honor to be here tonight. And I can remember sitting in the back of the meeting in Bakersfield, and it was up in the back of the they have kind of an arena there, not an arena, an auditorium, and I'm in the back, and I'm tired. I worked, and you know, everybody who's worked, and you feel like you're going to drop, and you think, is it worth it? Isn't? Well, tomorrow you'll know it's worth it again. But it was just in that time where I was so exhausted I could cry, and Betty H. was talking Sunday morning, Bakersfield, I believe it was. And she talked about the magic and the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that morning, I felt it for the first time. And I'd been sober a while. And I cried even more. You know, they say big boys don't cry, but real men do. And I learned that here, too. And that's very important for me. I tried to do my best. I'd goof up a lot. I had a sarcastic mouth. I can remember more than once my sponsor calling me to his office and said, Ed, that mouth of yours is running off the people who love you the most. You better do something. But I was so afraid to be liked, I didn't know what to do. And I wanted to sound quick, and I wanted to sound clever. And, you know, AA's great for one-liners. Well, I pass anymore. I don't want to be a great at one-liners because it hurts me and it hurts them, and it isn't funny anymore. And I'm real grateful for that. But I'm grateful for the information. I'm grateful for the people in AA who come up and said, you know, your behavior isn't appropriate. Because I didn't know. I had no way of knowing. and you love me enough to tell me the truth. I went to speak at a meeting in Pasadena, California. I'm living down on Venice Beach. I'm broke. And Pasadena's a wealthy area. And I thought, ooh, wealthy area, I might get a job. And I caught myself running that little con. And you see, I'd started all over with God. My first honest prayer was, God, I don't know if you're there or not. I sure hope so. And I went into the bathroom and I said a prayer that I said tonight before I came over. And that's, God, save me from my own nonsense. Let me just share the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous you've performed in my life. And I don't want anything from any of these people. And I went to that meeting in Pasadena. A guy came up to me afterwards and said, this makes no sense to me. Won't offer you a job. I said, it makes perfect sense to me. And he said, have you ever been in show business management? I said, no. He said, have you ever been to Taiwan? I said, no. He said, be in my office Monday morning. That was Saturday. Monday morning, I went to his office in Century City, and I talked to this guy. Thursday, I was lifting out of LAX on China Airlines, going to Taipei, Taiwan. I was the new soon-to-be vice president of America on Ice. I was going over find living arrangements and negotiate contracts for the cast of 62, and I was going to fly back and forth from Taipei to Hong Kong with designer Bill Campbell to design the costumes. How was your week? You know? And the reason I share that with you is somewhere along the lines, I dropped the bag of ones. There would have been a time when I wouldn't have even showed up for that interview. And my sponsor had convinced me that I can do more than I think I can. And I showed up. And I'm going to Taipei, Taiwan. I get off the plane and everybody's this tall. And they're looking at me and I'm looking at them, you know. I know it's just a matter of time before they tie me down. Yeah. I did read a few books. And I remember getting off the plane and there was a limo there, a Mercedes limo, with my name badly spelled, the chauffeur, and I got in that Mercedes limo and went to the President Hotel that at that time was owned by Madam Chiang Kai-shek, and I went to my six-room suite. And I belong there. Oh, I mean it. I really mean it. You see, God doesn't make mistakes like that. He put me there because I had the talent to be there. It took me a long time to realize that. You see, I was always a mistake. And you've taught me that I'm no mistake. That when good things happen to me, to celebrate them. And understand that they're not a freak accident, that I don't have to worry for the jig to be up next week, because I am a changed person because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved it. It was great. I was over there 6 months, and a guy walked by me one day and said, you know, you'd be an excellent manager for the Harlem Globetrotters. And I'm, yeah, sure, you got that right, yeah. And I came home, and I was home about 3 months, and I got a call from the Harlem Globetrotters. And they said, Mr. Mutum, we've heard wonderful things about you. Can you come up and talk to us? And I did. Of course, I called my sponsor and talked to him about it. But I showed up for the interview. And I told him the truth. I don't hide who I used to be. It don't own me anymore. Even the jerk I'd been in AA, even when I conned people out of money and I didn't even know I was doing it, I don't have to hide anymore because I'm a changed person because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to that interview, and it was a short 8 hours. And they gave me that job, and the next thing I know, I'm getting on a bus in Madison Square Gardens, and Metal Arc Lemons in one seat, and Curly Neal's in the other. And I got 10 grand cash in my pocket and every major credit card in the world. And I thought, dog, don't get much better than this. I was wrong. And it's the first time I ever heard my sponsor tell me he was proud of me. And I can't tell you how much that meant to me. Can't tell you. And I traveled all over the world. And that's what I dreamed when I was a kid. I lived in that little ghetto place, and I think one of these days I want to travel all over the world and meet famous people. And when I came to AA, that you told me to reclaim my dreams, and I challenged you. I thought, well, this will never happen. And I remembered that night I was on the bus when we were preparing for the European tour. And I traveled all over the world, and I had a wonderful time. But I can also remember being in a place Hotel La Palais that Napoleon had built for his mistress. She had something to offer, must have had. And I'm sitting there, and it's a 20-foot marble hallway, and I'm sitting on a velvet couch, and my French doors are open, and the ocean's splashing up underneath, and I'm on the phone to Clancy. And do you know what I'm saying? Hi, Clance, how you doing? How's everybody at the yard today? God, can't wait to get home. You've taught me some values here. And I used to think if I had all those things, it'd fix me. They're just things. They're nice, but they don't fix me. While I was over there, I met the daughter of the Turkish ambassador. She was Muslim, beautiful, wealthy. I thought, well, our backgrounds are a lot alike, so... I became familiar with terrorists long before it was fashionable. Everybody liked her. She was just an angel, and I was a jerk. God, it was horrible. And we should have never gotten married. We did. We have three children, which I don't regret at all. I don't have much of a relationship because they don't like me. I'm trying my best, but they just don't like me. And I'm okay with that today because I'm doing my best. That's all I can do. And I learned that here. And I'm okay with if they never want to talk to me. And that's a mouthful. Because all I ever wanted to be was a good dad. Now, how I could be one, I don't know, because I'd never had one. Closest I had is my sponsor, Clancy. He did a pretty doggone good job. But I am deficit in that area. And maybe always will be. But you know, as long as we're kind and loving to whoever we run into, we're good brothers and sisters to everybody. And that's what I try to be. We got divorced in 86. In 88, I made a stupid decision based on money and self. I didn't run it by Clancy. I didn't pray about it. They offered me big bucks, and I took it. And within 3 months, I lost everything I owned. And I was living in Burbank at the time and had a brand-new apartment up there, and it was, I don't know, $1,700 a month. Things were moving along. And that was in the 80s. It was 87. And I can remember my friend Jim B., who passed away this year, called me up one day and said, "How you doing, Ed?" And I said, "Fine." And I just heard a click, and he came over, and he drove me around all day. Because I was 18 years sober, and I couldn't make it another minute. And he called me right at the wrong time, right at the right time, and didn't believe I'm fine. You know, that's the friends I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. They've been few like that. I know a lot of people, but I have some genuine, wonderful friends in AA. And he saved my life. I went out to Iowa and I started fresh. I couldn't get anything going for the first time in a long time. I used to always get something going. I was in sales. I tried my best to be honest. I made good money and I made the companies I worked for good money. But I just couldn't get anything going and I was just dying. And, you know, after a while, you can't call your sponsor every 6 seconds. You know, you got to make some decisions on your own because there's new people out there that need it worse than we do. And I moved back to Iowa, and it was one of the best things I've ever done in 1988. And I moved to East 6th Street, which is the slum of the earth. And I had a house that a friend of mine in AA gave me, and the city let me pull the boards off and turn on the power when they shouldn't. And I went through that winter, and I broke out the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got better. I read parts in that book that said I'm supposed to be happy, joyous, and free, and I'm supposed to have a bit of heaven here on earth. And I thought, man, I got nothing like that, so I'm doing something wrong. It isn't the book. I used to have the great pleasure of sitting in Chuck's house when Clancy'd come down to speak on Wednesday night at Laguna. And Chuck would be sitting in his chair, and Clancy'd be sitting over here, and Chuck would be saying, "Love is God, and God is love, and it's just that simple, kid." Clancy'd say, "You got to get into action. You got to do this. You got to do that. You got to." And I'm thinking, God, they're both right. It just makes me crazy. And the thing that made me crazy makes me sane and keeps me sane today, because they were both right. You can have all the action you want, but if you don't get a God going sooner or later, it isn't going to work. And you can have all the God you want going, but if you don't put stuff into actions and do what we do here, it ain't going to work. We have the combination of both here, and they're wonderful. A few years after that, I quit smoking. I had a significant thought. It had been 30 years, and I thought, possibly this isn't good for me. So I quit smoking, and the doctor told me to go out and start running. So I started stretching and exercising, went out and ran, broke my leg. I thought, thanks, doc. And I'm sitting there at home, and one day God talks to me again. And God said, Ed, what about education? And I did what any good alcoholic would do. I went, la, 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 la. He don't care. He calls right back, you know. And when you're sober that long, you know one thing. I got my crutches, and I went over to take you to Marycrest University in Davenport, Iowa. And I said, excuse me, I'd like to go to school. And they said, how many credits do you have? And I said, I have bad credits. Why? What's that all about? And they laughed just like you did. But I learned many lessons, and one of them was I was able to look right at him and say, you don't get it. I don't know if I'm smart enough to pass a class. I don't know anything about going to school. But would you help me? I need to do this. And of course they said yes. Anybody, when I've asked sincerely from my heart, has said yes. And in 3 weeks I was going to school. And I worked full-time, and I went to school full-time, and I kept my AA commitments. So I'm not the one to say you don't have time. You know, if you want to do something in life, God will make the time. He'll give you those 30-hour days when you need them. At least that's been my experience. And within 3 weeks, I was going to school, and I didn't experientialize. I didn't clap out any of them. I took every single hour because I thought, if I get that degree, I want it to be mine. I don't want any shortcuts. I learned that here and through my sponsor. So it took me, I had about 60 hours in, and I went on a Christian retreat. A guy I'd sponsor, his dad just loved me and said, can I do this for you? And my sponsor taught me that I had to say thank you, toughest thing I knew to do. I remember one time we were in Ohio Street, and I was broken. Clance came up and slipped me $5. And pulled his hand away, and I said, oh, I can't take this. I can't, you know, gee, I can't. And in his mild manner way, he said, shut up! Just shut up! Why don't you just take it? Shut up, and don't you destroy the spirit of the giver. You have no idea why I'm giving that to you. In a kind and loving way. And one of the best lessons I've ever known, best lessons I've ever been taught, is to simply say thank you. Don't destroy the spirit of the giver. I love that. I love that. I love to just be able to say thank you and leave it there. I am good enough today. Last Wednesday, I turned 53 years old. And I'm 32 years sober. I woke up with the most amazing feeling. I was just delighted to be me. Didn't want to be anywhere else. And my life isn't perfect. But I'm closer to being that than I've ever been. And I don't want to change anything except keep growing. I am enough today. I've never been enough. You see, with me and my God and my program, I'm more than enough. Regardless of what's going on out there. What a freedom. I used to try to describe what AA did for me. And, you know, I've heard wonderful speakers over the years. And they didn't. And one day it just came to me what it is. You have given me something I never knew before I got here. I may have experienced it, but I don't remember it. You have restored my innocence. There are some days when I'm not wrong. I'm innocent. What a great feeling. Never knew I could have that one. Never knew it. And you gave it to me. It's one of my greatest gifts. There are whole weeks and months where I don't do anything wrong, where I don't get goofy and I don't, you know, I am still suspicious of people who still want to be crazy after a long time sober. You know, that tells me that they just don't want to change something they're doing. At least that's my opinion. You know, when I'm snappy and grouchy and tearing people's heads off, it's because I'm doing something in my life that I shouldn't be. That's what I know about me. And when I'm loving people, it's because I'm doing the best I can at whatever I can do. And I'm trying to make a life for everybody, knowing that God's going to take care of me. The God that you taught me about. I went on this Christian retreat and I had a spiritual awakening that changed my heart and my mind. That from that day to this. And I remember Clancy was talking out in Waterloo, Iowa. And I went up and I said, Clance, I've been called to the ministry and I want to talk to you about that. And he listened and I talked and he said, okay, Ed, you need to do this. And he was so warm and he was so loving. He really was. That night at the meeting, he got up to talk and he said, I'd just like to say Ed Mutum's going to be a minister. This is officially the end of God as we understand him. But I also need to tell you I have not had any more solid supporter in my ministry than Clancy. And for 8 years, things were wonderful. I went and I got my Master's of Divinity, a little 96-hour master's degree. And it took me 7 years, but I had time, day at a time. You told me I could do anything I wanted. And I went back to school at 42, and I graduated in 2000 with my master's. And I became ordained, and I've been with the Methodist Church for 9 years, 8 years, excuse me. And they had agreed when I came into the ministry that I could have one Sunday a month to come and speak in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I'm never going to get paid up. I'm not looking for rewards. I'm just looking to pay back. You know, I'm not doing this for insurance. I'm doing this for gratitude. You know, this place owes me nothing. Absolutely nothing. And they got a new bishop in, and they said, Ed, you can't do that anymore. You have to make a choice. And Clancy had been to that church, and it was a 1,200-member church, and it was just breathtaking. And the people there were breathtaking. You know, once you start looking for the 299s in the world, they're everywhere. They're not just in AA. They're everywhere. Oh, we got a lot of them here. But we got a lot of wonderful people out there. And to leave those 1,200 people was one of the toughest things I ever had to do. But I'd rather leave them than you. I felt it necessary for me to do this. So a year ago, I left that church, and they had a going-away dinner for me. And they had a roast. And 450 people showed up. And nobody'd get up and say anything bad about me, even in a teasing way, because they loved me. That's what you've done to me. You see, when I came here, nobody wanted me, included me. And now I'm blessed to have people want me all over the place. And I want to give all I can give, because whatever I've got, you've given me. About 3 years ago, I was preaching on forgiveness, and I was in the middle of a sermon, and I realized I hadn't forgiven the guys who killed my father. And I stopped in the middle of the sermon and said, I won't preach on forgiveness till I find him and I forgive him. As God would have it, 2.5 weeks later, one of the guys' sentence was overturned. 27.5 years later. And the press came to me. I'm well known in my community, and I'm well loved by how you taught me to act. In God's grace, believe me. And when that happened, the press came to me, and the Eighth Circuit Court said, release him or retry him right now. And they said, what do you want to do, Ed? And I said, let him go. It's time to heal. It's time to start new. And he said, he's been in there since he's been 17. He doesn't know how to work. He doesn't know how to support himself. What's he going to do? And I said, he can come live with me if he wants. And people were taken back by that. But Clancy put me in his house and fed me when nobody wanted me around. How could I offer any less? You know, if we're just going to like our friends, we're not worth much. If we're just going to give the ones that's easy, we're worth less. And it just came very natural to me. And that story literally went around the world. It was on the front page of the LA Times one morning. London Times, New York Times, Oprah called me, 48 Hours called me. How could you do this? And how could I say, well, it's step 8 and 9, Oprah. You know, it's just step 8 and 9. Okay? But it's a wondrous example of how the worst possible thing in the world God will use is one of the most healing things you've ever experienced. And 2.5 weeks later, I was walking in that prison that I swore I'd never go in, that my brother spent so many years in, and I'm shuffling down that hall and hearing those doors clang and saying a prayer. And I walk into a room to a guy that I hadn't seen for 27.5 years. Last time I sat in the courtroom with him, I thought, give me 5 minutes with him. We won't need a trial. And I stuck out my hand and I said, Sherman, my name's Reverend Ed Mutum. And I'm here to tell you that God loves you and I love you. And God forgives you and I forgive you. And if there's anything in my life I can ever do to make your life better, allow me to do that. And he looked in this old-timer's eyes, and he saw what I saw when those old-timers talked about God. He knew I meant it. There was no schemes. There was no games. And to make a long story short, they were going to retry him. And in Iowa, felony murder, if you're there, you're guilty. And by his own testimony, he was. And I went down and talked to the county attorney after I prayed a little bit about it. And I asked him to cut my friend a break, because something happened that caught me, amazed me, that we become friends and we talked. And I said, please let him plead to a lesser charge and let him come home. And He listened. And he gave my friend a break. And 2.5 years later, I picked him up from prison. And I was the one to be able to tell him, you can open your own door now. You know. And we went into a restaurant, and I was able to teach him how to order. I said, now she's going to ask you a bunch of questions right in a row, and she's not trying to hassle you. You know. You know what he's been 30 years of, you know. And she came through, how do you want your eggs, what toast? He said, Dad, that was a lot of questions, wasn't it? But I'll never forget walking out of that restaurant. He always called me Reverend Mutum, still does. He said, Reverend Mutum, can I just do something? And I said, what's that, Sherman? He said, can I just look at this pond for a minute? How many ponds do we pass? He hadn't been able to stop and look at one 30 years. He came home. It was too much for him. He went back. He violated and went back. Last March, I picked him up again and brought him home. And he's having a tough time. He's mad at me right now. He's mad at the world right now. So I usually don't ask people in AA for anything, but I'm going to make an exception. If you could keep my friend Sherman in your prayers, I'd appreciate it. Because he's had a bad life. And we found the answer here, and let's hope he finds one. Because he's a good guy, but just like me, he doesn't know it yet. And he had 30 years of people telling him he was worthless and thrown away. Since then, I started a new church, and things have been tough. Financially, I lost everything I owned in the last year, and that's just fine. I made some decisions that I thought about, and I planned out the best I could, and they just didn't work, and that's fine. Because I am enough today. I am enough. I got a little church that 30 people come to on Wednesday nights, and it's based in 12 steps in Scripture. And everybody that's there wants to be there. There's no guilt there. Come if you want to come. Don't come if you don't want to come. And we have a good time, and I am blessed to be able to go talk a lot today. I'll close with the story of talking at Founders Day this year. I was very blessed to do that, and they called me up, and they said, you know, you can bring a significant other. And I said, I don't have a significant other, and that's not an advertisement. I'm not looking for a significant other. I am doing just fine all by myself. Thank you very much. I like me. But they said, well, why don't you bring a newcomer? And this one guy came to mind immediately. His name's Hal. And Hal had watched his wife. He had been married for 38 years. And they had, by all accounts, a wonderful relationship. They were just so in love. And all of a sudden, his wife got cancer. And he'd been drinking all along. Well, when she got cancer, he really started drinking heavily. And on her deathbed, she said, please, go do something about your drinking. He said, when you're gone, I will. She died. Very shortly after that, Hal came to AA. He was sober 7 days and went to his doctor, and the doctor said, Hal, you got cancer. Now, it took Hal 6 months to even say his wife's name without him breaking down and sobbing. But Hal never missed a meeting. He never looked for an opportunity. He was a little annoyed that his group, you had to be a year sober to be a secretary. And he just got into the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he loved Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd come down to my office, and we'd just talk and he just was on fire with sobriety and wanting to help people and do something. And we had long talks about God, and he got to understand that God didn't take his wife. God welcomed his wife. Big difference. Big difference. God doesn't rip anybody out of our life, especially the innocent ones. He welcomes them. And Hal came to mind, so I took him to Akron. It was great. He had a wonderful time. We went to the house and the private tour, Dr. Bob's house, and sat at the table there. And a lot of the furniture, the original furniture, is back. So we sat at the original table, Bill and Bob did. And my treat was to watch Hal because he was just on fire. And he had a great time. And September 10th, Hal had a year. And we took him up in his wheelchair to have a year. And he died 3 days later. But it isn't a sad story. Because you see, the last days of Hal's life, he could talk openly about his wife and not cry anymore. He talked about the joys of being sober. And he was the first one to greet newcomers at meetings. He'd make sure they had a cup of coffee and were welcome. He was such an excellent example of what we have here that we take for granted every day. I got a goal today in life. I hope you got a goal. My goal is simple. A few years back, I was watching the Actor's Studio, and Danny Glover was on there. And at the end of that interview, they always ask the same question. If there is a heaven when you die, what do you hope God would say when you get to those pearly gates? And Danny Glover thought for a minute, was quite reflective. Then he looked at him and said, "Thank you." Imagine if I live my life so when I die, God said thank you. You see, it's always been about what can he do for me. That's my goal. We call it nay, being a maximum service to God and our fellows around us. I love my life today. I love everything about my life, even the difficulties, because I can't wait to see what God's going to do with them. I got a little bill for $500,000 in back child support. I opened that bad boy up and laughed. Said, "Can't wait to see what you're going to do with this mess, God." And I'm doing the paperwork and all that, but you know what? They don't own me anymore. I was even plotting there for a while. If I had to go to jail, I'd start a meeting, you know? Because wherever I go, there's a use for me. And I don't blame God for the bad things in my life because I'm too busy thanking him for the good things and the good people in my life. Guys like Johnny and Clancy and Keith and my friend Sally, who taught me how to eat properly, who taught me how to speak properly. I remember the day I asked Clancy, I said, "How do you be a gentleman?" He said, "You act that way, Ed." And I would have never thought of that. Today I'm known as a gentleman because I try to act like one. And I am most grateful that you have made me who I am today. And I can't wait to see who you're going to be, because it's good. The best is yet to come. That's what my sponsor has told me for 30 years. The best is yet to come. And by golly, I believe him. Thank you.